Coming up on Tech Nation, sports ecologist Dr. Madeline Orr, a professor at the University of Toronto and author of Warming Up, How Climate Change is Changing Sport. Then, Tech Nation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the medical innovation gap, the time from innovation to when we actually get access. Then, Geron Corporation's Dr. John Scarlett talks about their groundbreaking work in a condition called MDS, a failure of the bone marrow. Today, it requires regular blood transfusions just to keep living. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take Five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
In 2011, National Geographic explorer in residence Wade Davis wrote Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Today, a full century later, we have satellite imaging and GPS, satellite phones, and the experience of 100 years of climbing. But in the 1920s, what did climbers know about climbing Mount Everest?
Well, they knew very, very little more. I mean, you know, Everest had sort of emerged in the last years of the Raj as sort of the third pole. You know, the British and Empire of Explorers had lost the race for the North and South Pole, and here in their very midst was this third pole that rose into the heavens. And so the quest for Everest began really as a sort of a gesture of redemption for an Empire of Explorers that had lost those races. But because of the intervening war, where so much of Britain was destroyed by the Mud of Flanders, it emerged as a kind of a gesture of regeneration for a nation bled white by war. So that was always my interest in the story of George Mallory.
In a sense, the empire, the great global empire of Britain, has really been gnawed by the Great War.
Well, you know, that was a seminal event of our times. You know, Churchill famously described the Second World War as just second half of the First World War. He called it the 30 Years' War. And he famously said, never was there a war less necessary to fight than the first, or more necessary to win than the second. I became interested in the story of George Mallory really in a serendipitous way. I was traveling 4,000 miles across Tibet as part of an ecological survey in the spring of 96 when the disaster happened on Everest that John Krakauer so powerfully wrote about in his book Into Thin Air. And with me was Daniel Taylor, who was a son and grandson of medical missionaries, and his father had been a great friend of Howard Somerville, who climbed with George Mallory in 1922 and 24. And the very next fall, Daniel and I were back on the east face of Everest, in the Kanchung face, in the Gamma Valley, trying to photograph clouded leopards. And Daniel, in his inimitable way, began to speak of these Englishmen in tweeds reading Shakespeare to each other in the snow at 20,000 feet. And that was the Everest of his imaginings, not the kind of ignoble commercial world of today. And as he spoke to me, I became enchanted by these men. Who were they? And I was never interested in whether George Mallory made it to the top or not on that fateful day. You know, the story goes, on June 8th, 1924, he's spotted by Noel Dell with his young companion, Sandy Irvin, going strong for the top on the Northeast Ridge, with a mist coming in that envelops their memory and myth, and they have never seen or heard from again. The question is, did Mallory make it before he died? And what interested me is what spirit carried him on. In 1921, the reconnaissance of Everest was just that. They had to find the mountain. They had to march 400 miles off the map
To find it,
to get to the base of a place that had been seen from Kampazong, but never approached by any European. And on that approach march, a high-altitude physiologist by the name of Arthur Kellis, 56 years old, too old for Everest, famously died of exhaustion. And he was buried at a Tibetan fort called Kampazong. Now, according to historians of Everest, in 1921, only one man kept a journal. But I found alive, 4 doors from the house I was born in Vancouver, the son of a man who did, Oliver Wheeler, unknown, unsung hero of 1921, the man from the Survey of India, seconded to the expedition, the man, not Mallory, it was Wheeler who found the doorway to the mountain, the route up the East Roanoke to the North Col. He was the one who famously found the chink in the armor of Everest. And Wheeler kept a journal, and when I visited his son, he pulled these 2 volumes off his shelf, and I was breathless. never before seen by every historian.
You've been listening to a 2011 TechNation interview with National Geographic Explorer-in-Residence Wade Davis about his book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Today, a University of British Columbia anthropology professor, Wade Davis has recently published Magdalena, River of Dreams, A Story of Columbia. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, climate change is affecting everything, including sports. Dr. Madeline Orr is a sports ecology professor at the University of Toronto. She's here today with Warming Up, How Climate Change is Changing Sport. Then TechNation Health chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the medical innovation gap, the time from the actual innovation until we can use it in everyday practice. And Dr. John Scarlett, the president and CEO of Geron, tells us about their breakthrough drug candidate, which treats a condition which is a failure of the bone marrow. To date, regular transfusions were the only treatment.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Dr. Madeline Orr. Dr. Orr, welcome to TechNation.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I must say, I have never heard of sports ecology or a sports ecologist. Is this a new field?
It is, actually. Just in the last 15 years or so, it's popped up right at the intersection of environmental science and kinesiology, so your sports science.
So you write in the book that you started your interest in the effect of climate change on sports with a seasonal job and an experience in Switzerland. No snow, too much snow, injuries, even avalanches. Tell us how that all started.
Yeah, I mean, I was young and thought I was going out to be a ski bum for a season. And yeah, I got out there. My job was to help set up the events and run the extras and the tours and stuff. So in theory, quite fun. And then we got no snow. So, you know, we got through November, no snow, nothing's open. December, nothing's open. It opens kind of late December with no good snow on the mountain. They've made it all. And they've closed every run except maybe two or three, which means there's loads of collisions happening because you've got all the little kids next to all the experts and it's just a hodgepodge. And so I found myself going back and forth from the mountain to the ER every day, taking people to the hospital. And I was talking to the orthopedic surgeon saying, is this strange? Are you surprised by this? Because there's no snow to speak of. And they go, no, actually, when the snow's not good, we see actually more injuries. And I said, well, why is no one talking about that? And they said, oh, it's not popular to talk about that in ski country. So I thought, okay, well, yeah. And then we got the snow finally in January and it came all at once, which is usually a sign of avalanches coming. Because if you get that much snow, it drops all at once and it drops onto frozen ground, it's just going to slide across that frozen ground. And that's what happened. And we had a few losses at our neighboring resorts and it was very sobering. And that, you know, avalanches happen. They're tragic whenever they happen and take a human life. But to get 5 kids lost at one mountain, 2 Czech teenagers at another, kind of within a few days of each other, it was a big wake up call that this isn't normal. And this can't continue. And it's not just about the tourism dollars and the business. It's actually a health issue that climate change is impacting this sport. And once I saw it, I couldn't unsee it. And I started seeing it everywhere. So picked up a career in it.
Now, time passes. You find yourself in Rio de Janeiro for the Summer Olympics of 2016. Now, I happen to know that exactly a year before any Olympics, there's a pre-Olympics. That's what they call it. And every nation sends athletes to get the lay of the land or water, depending on the sport, to see if the venue's ready, if the officials are ready, if there's a problem with anything. And everybody's, you know, getting, okay, strategically, this is what we have to do. And 1 year before that 2016 Olympics, in 2015, Rio had problems, as in 32 tons of dead fish.
Yeah, can you imagine?
No.
Here you are ready to paddle or swim, and you look out at the water, and that's what you see at your test event. It wasn't pretty. And then the athletes came back in 2016, a year later, having been promised it would be better. And it wasn't much better. I mean, they'd done some work, but they'd promised billions in recovery and restoration of these areas that didn't happen. It was a couple hundred million that was committed to it, if that. And it was pretty dire. So I was watching athletes get out of the water with, you know, rashes up their legs and coughing from the pollution. And it's a shame because they're here to compete at what should be the highest level and in pristine conditions and with the every opportunity to set records and be great on TV and, you know, make everybody proud. And this is what they're faced with. So it was jarring to come off a winter season that didn't have snow and get to a summer sport event and see it also upset with all kinds of environmental issues.
So you were committed the first time, and now you're like rabid about sports ecology.
Then I was in.
All in. Now, as you say, the climate isn't going to adapt to sports. Sports has to adapt to climate change, or at very least weather, the current weather.
Yeah.
And that brings me to ask you about individual athletes. Mm. Let's talk about heat stroke.
Yeah. So heat stroke is currently, we call it a silent killer. It's one of the leading causes of death among youth athletes in North America at the moment, according to the Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury Research, which is at the University of North Carolina. They've been tracking this for years, and it's going up with heat stroke. And the reason it's going up is we're seeing more days of heat and fewer people prepared to handle it. So in certain pockets of the country where they may have had heat for a very long time, and August and September are always really hot, they're a little more used to it. But there's, you know, we're seeing heat waves in Illinois, we're seeing heat waves in Arkansas, like places that shouldn't, historically wouldn't have had that kind of heat. And it's really taking its toll. And the challenge with heat stroke is the initial signs and symptoms of a heat event for an athlete kind of look like any hard practice. It's fatigue, it's cramping, it's maybe a bit of nausea. And if you told me, and I didn't know what I know, that, you know, we had a practice and a couple of kids were struggling with it, and by the end of the practice, you know, they were maybe puking off to the side, I'd say, okay, like that sounds like a hard practice. But unless you told me the context of the heat, a lot of people don't know to consider that. And so they're not thinking this is a symptom of heat stress. It's not necessarily just that they push themselves too hard. And that's where we see athletes competing and playing and training in conditions they shouldn't be playing in or that they should have breaks from. And that intervention isn't happening. So where we should ordinarily see, you know, more cooling breaks, time to take some water, get into the shade for a few minutes, take a break. If it doesn't happen and they continue to go despite feeling a bit queasy, getting those cramps, feeling fatigued, it can escalate within 30 minutes to the point of major internal damage, which can result in death. And it has, especially in football. So that's going to only get worse unless we get people accustomed to looking for those symptoms and catching them early.
Well, the people themselves, I keep thinking of all the coaches, the assistant coaches, and in a high school setting, that often means the buddy who he's teaching math until 2 p.m. And then,
yeah.
I mean, it's like he's the assistant coach. He volunteered because, you know, and it's like, how trained are our coaches at, I'm saying the high school level, we can go right up to college and professional. But I'm more concerned, I think, about the high school level, because we always, oh, those kids are healthy as heck, and we kind of patchwork together who the coaches are. Are there national standards for what you have to do as a coach, or what?
So as of now, there's no national standard. There are some states that have implemented policies around heat. So that would look like a threshold at which you would shorten practice or add heat breaks, and a second threshold at which you would just cancel it. Now, That's a very basic protocol. I don't think it's hard. And I think it takes as much as the next 30 seconds to tell a coach, hey, by the way, if it's hot outside, give your athletes a break, make sure they're hydrated. And if they pop up with any of the following symptoms, flag it and don't let it get worse. And it's 100% preventable, right? That's the good news, is we don't have to have any kid dying of this. It's ridiculous that it's continuing, despite the hazards cropping up more and more. So I think it's just about letting people know, hey, look out for this. And when they do, we see all the interventions happen as quickly as they need to, and we avoid it altogether.
And yet the rules for all these games were made for a different climate.
That's right.
And not only that, they selected the particular sports because of that climate. Can we even consider rule changes?
Yes. And I would say we have to at some point, you know, in certain parts of the country already. If you're in Northern California, Oregon, Washington, the beginning of your football season in August, September, October is fire season. If you're in the Southeast, it's hurricane season. And basically across the whole entire swath of the country, if you're playing American football and training through your summer, getting ready for the fall season, it's heat. So you see it runs the full gamut of hazards. But we did some research looking at what it would look like to shift that schedule back just a couple weeks. Start the season in September, later September. That way preseason is in September. And if you do that, we avoid most of the worst case scenarios.
Hey, but that gets into basketball season. Are you crazy? Then what
happens? Well, that's
happens?
The thing, right? Sports loves tradition. So it's hard. But I think, look, like we have proof of concept that rescheduling works. We saw it during COVID. We saw every sport switch around its schedule and people still played, and that was the way we kept it going. Was it perfect? No. And the purists grumbled, sure, but it kept people safe. And I think at the end of the day, like if sport can't be safe, it can't be fun. So
you're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is sports ecologist Dr. Madeline Orr. Dr. Orr is a professor at the University of Toronto and founder and co-director of the Sport Ecology Group, which consults on international climate issues for sports organizations, including such familiar ones as the NCAA, World Athletics, and Adidas. She's here today with Warming Up, How Climate Change is Changing Sport. Now, I saw two terms, and I don't know what the difference is. What's the difference between acclimation acclimatization?
Yeah, acclimation and acclimatization.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Yeah, what's the difference?
So the only difference between acclimation and acclimatization is where they happen. They both have to do with getting an athlete ready to compete in certain conditions, usually heat. So if we're preparing athletes to go to Paris, for example, this summer, it's going to be hot. There's not a lot of air conditioning in Paris. So we're going to try to prepare their bodies to cope with that heat and perform in those conditions. And acclimation is what would happen in a chamber. So you would have a heat chamber, you would turn up the temperature, you'd have them train in there 7 to 14 days, and that will give them that edge that allows for us to prepare them for that heat environment and reduce the risks of heat stroke. Acclimatization is the same thing, except instead of a heat chamber, you actually go to that environment itself or a like environment. So for Paris, you might go to Barcelona. It's equally kind of dry and hot and not too humid. And you would compete in those conditions. So that's where we see training camps. So many, many countries will send athletes to training camps instead of heat chambers, because you can get more athletes out in those conditions than the ones you can fit in a chamber.
Now, here in San Francisco, several years back, we were so surprised to spend several days in smoke. You see, north of us, there were wildfires, and normally they blow toward the middle of the United States. They blow east. But this time the wind changed, which is what made the fire so bad. And the smoke went out to the Pacific Ocean. The wind went back to normal. And all of that smoke came through San Francisco for several days. I mean, if you kept thinking, you'd wake up and think there's a fire here, you weren't even supposed to go out. What do they do? What do you do about that? How do you check that in sports?
Yeah. So the Bay Area is actually a really good one to come to on this, because the Bay Area's sports organization, so your 49ers, the A's, which aren't there anymore, but we can pretend they are. At the time they were, and some of the other organizations, including your colleges, actually sat down at a table together and put together policies on how they would respond to air quality because of that smoke event in 2018 around the campfire and again in 2021. So What we know about air quality is that if you are sitting outside and breathing through your nose normally, it's not that bad until it gets really high into that pollutant content matter. So high in that AQI index. If you're breathing heavily, huffing and puffing, taking it in through your mouth, bypassing those natural filtration systems of your nose, as you would if you were doing exercise or running or that kind of thing, you are more at risk. And the reason you're more at risk of taking in pollutant content is because you're going to take in more volume of air and it's going to go straight to your lungs and it's going to reach your bloodstream faster. Now, some air pollutants like ozone, a little bit bigger, not as big a problem. I wouldn't say do it every day, but it's not too bad. Wildfire smoke is nasty. You don't want that anywhere near your lungs, and especially not at high volume. So at one point, there was a 49ers game about to kick off, and they had athletes on the sidelines wearing oxygen masks, and they were trying to decide what to do. This was before these policies came into play. One of the doctors on site was calculating how much pollutant content would get into an athlete's lungs over the course of the game. And they said it would be up to roughly smoking 10 full packs of cigarettes just in the course of that one game, which is gross. And no athlete would want that. So it's important that we have these policies. It's important that they're not just for the elite athletes, but all the way down to your little kids, because the kids are going to look outside and say, oh, it smells funny, but I still want to play. And if mom and dad don't know better, they might say, yeah, okay, get out of the house, go have fun. But it's important that we reduce that exposure time. So again, it's just about exposure time. It's not don't go out at all. It's don't do any vigorous activity. Make sure you can still breathe through your nose. So if you're going out, go for a walk, that's fine. Keep it short and then get back inside. But in those really, really high AQI situations, which you had for a few hours there during that event, I would say don't go out at all.
You quote Jake Howard, who is a surf journalist. He says, every surfer knows not to go in the water after rain. You wait 72 hours at least. I had no idea. Is that true everywhere?
Yeah. Actually, in some parts of the world, in Australia, they'll actually wait longer. So it just depends on where you are. But the kind of common wisdom around surfing and being in the water is that if you get a huge downpour of rain, that rain is going to pull all of the gas that leaked out of people's cars and all of the trash that's on the road and everything that's on the side of the road, it's going to pull it into the gutters. That's eventually going to make its way to the river and to the ocean. So the water is more polluted after a storm, and that will go away. It'll reset itself after a day or two, but you want to wait that out. There are people who don't want to, and they will go out and they are in pretty dirty water, and you just don't want to do that. Again, it's not going to hurt you if you did it just once, but if this becomes a pattern, you could start to see infections, bacterial issues, breathing issues potentially as it hits your respiratory system. So these are the kinds of challenges that surfers are well aware of. Open water swimmers, same thing. And actually paddlers will do the same. So if you're a paddler and you're on a river that tends to be polluted, you'll wait after rain. You won't go right away.
Many surprising things in your book. Now, it's not surprising to hear that athletes need their sleep to perform optimally. Everybody needs their sleep to perform optimally. But I didn't realize that there might be a link, or there is a link, between climate change and sleep. What is that?
Yeah. So that's a little further out from my area of expertise, but I can speak to it to the extent that it impacts athletes and people who are going to play outside. I was in Kenya and I was working with runners there. And then it came up in that context initially. And then I started seeing it elsewhere, where if it's really hot at night and you're not able to get a good night's sleep, it's going to impact your motivation, your energy level, how well you can perform, but it's also going to impact your cognitive capacity. So how well you can concentrate, it impacts kids in school, people in the workplace, and it becomes a real big challenge. This was something that Oregon ran into as well. So when I was in Oregon, they talked about it out of the heat dome. Folks that didn't have air conditioning had issues sleeping. And it came up again in California around the fires, issues around people who were evacuated had a hard time sleeping in evacuation centers or in their temporary housing or wherever they were. And when you can't sleep, you can't perform. So when sleep is impacted, whether it's because of a fire or because of air quality or because of heat, which is the big one, it's going to impact your performance.
There are also sports that are so popular. Everybody wants them everywhere, regardless. I mean, we're at fault here in California, because here in San Jose, which is normally a very, very nice climate, of course, we built an entire arena and have the San Jose Sharks professional ice hockey team, you know, go Sharks. It's like, wait a minute, it never snows here. Wait a minute, what are we thinking? But then I went all the way and I saw that in Qatar, an Arab country, which is slightly smaller than this very small state of Connecticut, Qatar is mostly desert, where temperatures during much of the year rise to, wait for it, 110 degrees. And yet they have four very green golf courses. Let's take that as a jumping off point for what are we doing with, you know, the sports and what life is like today.
It's a good question. It's the question I'm asking all the time. There has been a big push to expand opportunities for people to play, regardless of the sport and regardless of the geography. And in a lot of ways, that's been great. It's meant that, you know, people in Florida can play golf and hockey, and people in Arizona can play golf and hockey, things that may not happen ordinarily. And this has been important for mental health, physical health, all these other benefits that we know are associated with playing sport. Now, the challenge with that is it comes at a cost. So the more artificial something is, the more it's going to cost financially, not just to keep it up, but for people to access. And it's going to have a heavier cost on the environment. And so this is not something that was really taken into consideration as this expansion program around the world kicked off. And if you think about the big, big sports organizations of the world, your International Olympic Committee, your FIFA, golf organizations, their mission statement is to have more people play and watch their sport. So for them, the strategy is grow. And again, there's a lot of really good reasons to do that, but there's also some reasons to maybe think about where that's going to happen, how it's going to happen. The latest kind of outrageous example is the Saudi Arabia is going to host the Winter Asian Games in 2029 in a completely fabricated winter environment. And that is ringing alarm bells for me, because we've really stepped beyond the bounds of what nature can do in certain places. And at a certain point, we're going to have to start thinking really critically about where we grow sport, and should all sports grow in all places, or should we be thinking about what makes the most sense as an opportunity in a given place, given the geography and the resources that are there, the natural setting.
Now, sports is going to continue in one way or another, and in probably many, many different ways. You gave some thought to a future of sports. You say what could sports 2050 look like? Well, that's 25 years from now. What do you see?
Yeah, I'm really hoping that some of the worst case scenarios we paint in that part of the chapter don't come true. I'm really hoping we do better than this. But some of the things we were thinking about, this was part of an exercise with colleagues at the BBC.
I'm speaking with Dr. Madeline Orr. Her book is Warming Up, How Climate Change is Changing Sport. We'll talk more after a break. Tech Nation programs, or simply biotech-only interviews, are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, technation.com and biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, Tech Nation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the medical innovation gap, and Dr. John Scarlett, the President and CEO of Geron Corporation, talks about addressing a condition called MDS, a failure of the bone marrow. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with University of Toronto professor Dr. Madeline Orr. Her book is Warming Up: How Climate Change is Changing Sport.
This was a part of an exercise with colleagues at the BBC who asked a few years ago what would happen if we landed ourselves in a future where climate change happened how we expect it might, which means hazards are going to get worse. They're going to be more often. Winter is going to pretty much go away. And so we imagined a world in which there will be very few ski resorts that remain viable economically, but also naturally. There will be very few golf courses that remain viable. If you think about how much water they have to pull in order to be viable in some places, I don't know that that'll be legal coming, in 20 years' time, given water restraints in certain parts of the world. If you think about, indoor hockey, another example, surf pools, all these different things. So we envisioned a world where we're going to see the schedule shift. We're going to see participation patterns shift. We're going to see a more regional version of sport, which means that up to college, there's no reason for kids to be traveling out of state to compete in anything if there's enough opportunities for kids in their own state to play and compete against. And how do we regionalize that a little bit more? There's going to be certain challenges as well around what fans can do and can't do. So having hundreds of thousands of fans travel to an Olympic Games might not be an option. It might be that there will be restrictions on ticket sales and a quota of tickets will be restricted to locals. And then there will be fewer tourists. So it will be less of a tourism spectacle. That doesn't mean we can't watch it on TV and cheer them on and that family and friends of the athletes can't go and be there. But it won't be the hundreds of thousands of tourists that descend upon a place like Rio or Tokyo or Paris. It will still be fun. It's going to be a little different. I think we'll come around to that.
Well, Dr. Orr, thank you so much. I hope you come back. See us again.
Thank you for having me.
My guest today is Dr. Madeline Orr. Her book is Warming Up: How Climate Change is Changing Sport. It's published by Bloomsbury Sigma. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. We hear about one medical or health innovation after another. But how long does it take for it to become standard practice? TechNation Health Chief Correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft. Daniel, welcome back.
Great to see you on the radio.
On the radio. We can see everybody. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Now, one thing that we all know about, and I know you trace again and again, is just innovation. Medical innovations, health innovations, and yet innovation is one thing, but it has to get to people. It has to get into medical practices when it takes doctors and healthcare institutions to make it part of their system and normal treatments. What is that gap that we're talking about between the time we've innovated and it actually gets into use?
Yeah, the classically given example is it takes 17 years for something being published in a journal like New England Journal of Medicine to then become common practice. And that's frankly too long. We can't wait 17 years for a new drug to be discovered and to make a clinical impact. And so I think there's a bit of a new focus on, that's different terms, like translational medicine, going from something being published and known and proven to something that's going to be useful at the bedside or the website. And a lot of that's being driven by our new era of big data and AI that can start to make sense of the data. We're sort of awash in data. Data is sort of the new oil, as it were. But oil is a bit of so what? You want the oil to turn into gasoline to power your car to get somewhere, in a sense. And so we have an opportunity to take all these new massive data sets that are becoming more available, low-cost gene sequencing, data from electronic medical records, from wearables and the digital environment, all the way to things that might be recorded in telemedicine and your Internet of Things home, to take those massive data sets that are often siloed and take them from data to insights. And then those insights can hopefully then translate to something. If I'm seeing you in the clinic, Moira, as my patient, I'm not just sort of thinking back to some journal article I may or may not have read that cited some 10-year-old double-blind placebo-controlled trial. I could be looking at the crowdsourced data from thousands or maybe millions of patients like you and using that to do the right workup, to run the right test, to pick the right therapy. It might be a drug, a gene therapy, a digital therapeutic. And so my hope, and a lot of folks are working on, is sort of starting to connect all these new forms of data and insights, crowdsourcing them from around the world and enabling patients to become data donors, so that we can build a bit of a new model for how we do clinical trials, how we learn in real time, and how we can learn from each other in this new era of sort of crowdsourced health and medicine.
Now, along the way, there has to be some, I don't know what you would call, challenges, resistances, obstacles. I mean, it has to be accepted at each of these steps. Where are the resistances and how might they be overcome?
Well, a big concern, resistance, obviously, of course, is privacy. Most folks want to keep their medical data relatively private. Though I think the next generation, they'll share everything. And right, it may not be their HIV diagnosis, but they're willing to share their blood pressure and their vitals and their sleep, particularly if it can help them and other patients like them. So I'm trained as a pediatric oncologist. Almost every kid is part of a clinical trial who might be unfortunate to have cancer. That's helped really catalyze new learnings to cure many cancers in children and now in adults. Only 20% or less of our adults are part of clinical trials. But now almost everybody can opt in to sharing their health and medical data. And it can be done in safer and more reliable ways using technologies like blockchain to keep data anonymized and accessible only by folks who should access it. But I like to sort of think about the future of health knowledge, sort of like how we've shifted how we do our driving. You know, 15 years ago, we still used to drive with paper maps. Remember those? Now it'd be hard to imagine getting around without Google Maps or Waze. And Google Maps or Waze are crowdsourced data shared by other drivers on the road. You might not know it, but I could tell if I interrogated your Google data where you were at 2 a.m. last Thursday. But when you put that data together, we could get the knowledge of...
Because you knew.
I knew.
We were both in Florida.
We were in Florida. but what gets exciting is, you know, you want that hyperlocal data about the folks driving down the 280 highway near San Francisco. You don't really care about the highways in New York, right, and what's happening in Paris. Same thing for healthcare. If you can start to glean knowledge from other patients on similar journeys and similar cars with similar, let's say, genetics, we can start to build better healthcare maps for all. I like to sort of think about like a Waze for clinicians. In fact, I've been helping a startup called Stuff That Works. Health, that's a website out of Israel, where patients, thousands of them now, are sharing their what's working or not working for certain diseases. And it can help individuals then learn what's going to work for my plantar fasciitis or for my long COVID or for my migraines. And hopefully that sort of crowdsourced knowledge will integrate into our medical records and into the medical workflows of clinicians, so that when you're seeing a patient, you don't have to look for that randomized, very narrow study. We can glean knowledge from thousands of patients in your hospital system or from around the planet.
Well, it makes such sense. Yes, we're doing very, very significant and considered trials with more and more people until we can say, yeah, this is safe enough and effective enough that we're going to approve this drug. And then we let it in the wild. And like all these people use it, but we don't know anything about it. The truth is that we need to be able to make that into a constant cycle, because it will save lives. It may not save your life, but what you're doing may save someone else's, and vice versa. You may be standing there, but because other people contributed, it will inform yours. So it has to be a mindset change for everyone.
Right. And realizing that when we do sort of make that data available and shared, including what drugs are working or not working, we might even understand how we might repurpose a drug for a rare disease that it wasn't being applied for in the past. So there's a real power in sharing information about drugs, what's working, what's not working, connecting that to diseases that often don't have cures today. You just aired on TechNation, my friend, Dr. David Fagebaum, a professor at UPenn, who's launched Every Cure, a nonprofit to help build amazing data sets and insights to match an already FDA-approved drug that might be sitting on the shelf that might cure diseases, like he has Castleman's disease, that was cured by a generic drug. So really exciting ways to encourage folks to become data donors. And we need to build that into our health system so you can get an easy share button to unleash some of your data to help others. And eventually, I think this sort of blends into sort of this era of, just like we have crowdsourced maps, those are impacting self-driving cars. I was in San Francisco a few months ago and I had my first ride in a self-driving car from a company called Waymo. And what's exciting about it, it was very exciting the first time, you know, you press the button in the app, this car drives up without a driver,
yeah.
You get in and it takes you to where you're going. And so my insight was, what if healthcare was a little bit more like self-driving? So imagine a future of health and medicine where our health journeys were more like an AI-enabled self-driving car experience. They were sort of on demand. It knew where you wanted to go, what your destination was before it arrived. You knew what the pricing was because it was transparent, unlike our healthcare systems. The journey would adapt based on the weather and the traffic and was informed by crowdsourcing hundreds and thousands of journeys by other cars on the same streets. It would adapt to the weather, the traffic, your preferences. The driver's always alert, unlike your doctor or your nurse who might need to sleep. And that had a beautiful intuitive user interface, again, with transparent pricing that would get you from here to there, you know, faster, better, cheaper. Not going to replace all taxis or Ubers or Lyfts, but a taste of how some of those lessons from crowdsourcing and AI and big data and smart maps could apply to our sort of self-care healthcare journeys of the near future.
Well, we won't call it Waymo. We'll call it Waymo. Way more than this.
Healthmo. And what's interesting in this sort of new, you know, self-health era, you can now go online now and access lots of things that used to require a doctor visit. It could be through telehealth. I think we're going to enter this era of what I like to call not just, you know, generative AI, which is certainly really impacting healthcare, but generative health, where we can create those health environments around us that are really going to help us stay on track or not just to improve a behavior or provide those virtual environments or digital fingerprints and nudges that really match our age, culture, language, incentives, and our health journeys. So it's an exciting time now to go from big data to insights to action and, again, speed up, not practice incremental medicine, but exponential medicine and health for all, where we can take these lessons and speed up their impact around the planet.
Great points. Hey, thank you, Daniel. Come back soon.
See you, Moira, and I hope I'll hear about your self-driving healthcare journeys of the near future.
TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of NextMed Health, on the web at nextmed.health and digital.health. More information about Daniel at danielkraftmd.net. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to TechNation. Can you imagine having to get a blood transfusion every few weeks just to continue living? That's what life is like for the 20 to 30,000 new patients each year and numerous more who suffer from a condition called MDS. Dr. John Scarlett is president and CEO of Geron Corporation. Dr. Scarlett, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Mara. I really appreciate it.
Now, before we start, I do want to tell everyone that Geron has a drug which has made it successfully through the phase 3 clinical trials. We're always saying, how are you doing? Where are you in the phase 3 clinical trials? And has what we call a PDUFA date coming up with the FDA, where the FDA hopefully is going to say thumbs up. It usually says thumbs up, but let's make sure we get there. And that's when we can commercialize and go to market. But before we do that, let's lay some groundwork. If there's one thing we all need, and we know we need it, it's for our bodies to produce blood cells, good, healthy blood cells in the quantities we need. Now, we're talking about MDS today. What is it? How is it treated?
MDS, which stands for myelodysplastic syndrome, is a bone marrow cancer that results in inadequate production of blood cells. And in the form of MDS that we're studying, those cancerous cells take over the bone marrow and do not produce the normal amounts of red blood cells, which is the oxygen-carrying portion of blood that's so important for our daily lives. And so patients with MDS, the version we study, they become anemic and eventually become transfusion dependent. So the goal is, above all, to get them off of transfusions, if at all possible.
How often do they have to get a transfusion?
So it's a progressive disease, and what might start out as sort of a watch and wait, eventually these patients sometimes become mildly transfusion dependent, meaning they may only need one or two units of red blood cells every couple of months, but eventually they become heavily transfusion dependent. And that's actually a really terrible thing from a couple of perspectives. One, they're tethered to, they have to be in an infusion center to get those transfusions very frequently, often as frequently as every other week. And that entails a lot of logistics, a lot of driving, waiting around for blood to be cross-typed and matched. Sometimes the blood has to be brought in from another center because they didn't have the right blood for them. And so they become really dependent becoming dependent on these transfusions also means they become really hobbled. Their quality of their life, their daily living is really hobbled by that. And so they may take upwards of 10 units of red cells every couple of months. And that in and of itself also causes dangers. Red blood cell transfusions cause deposition of iron in major organs, and that can cause failure of those organs. And so there's lots of things that transfusions do that you would really like to make people transfusion-free or reduce the burden of transfusion as much as possible.
So here's where Geron comes in. This is where you're working. What is your drug doing specifically? Because I know in the overall, you want to get them off those transfusions. But what is it doing specifically about this condition?
So our drug is what is called a telomerase inhibitor. And, you know, all cells ordinarily have a normal life cycle. They get born, they do whatever they do as cells, and then they die in a pretty orderly fashion. And they die after, you know, proliferating a few rounds, and then they senesce and die. But cancer cells in general, and these MDS cells in particular in our case, actually have an enzyme in the bone marrow that is upregulated called telomerase, which causes those cells to continue to proliferate. And as long as that enzyme is present and upregulated, they're going to become much longer lived and, as I say, proliferate at very high rates. So a telomerase inhibitor is intended to take away that enzyme's action, and then the cells become more like normal cells, and eventually the proliferation lowers, they apoptose and die.
Now, if I understand what you're saying, is that if I had this condition, these cells would like not die, filling up my bone marrow. They're not producing healthy blood cells. So over time, I have fewer and fewer of those. And what your drug is doing is it's going in and finding those cells and saying, no, I'm afraid you're going to have to die, which makes room for your healthy blood cells.
That's exactly right, Mara. Just as you alluded, in patients treated with a telomerase inhibitor, ideally, they become far less dependent on or not dependent on transfusions to address their anemia, and lots of other good things happen to them in that regard. So that's a key goal of treatment.
Now, as I said earlier, you have not only gotten into phase three, you've completed phase three, and that meant phase one went well. Phase two went well, and now you really have a good body of knowledge. Tell us about this phase three trial. What did you do? Who was in it? How long did it last?
Right. So this was a study that was done in many, many centers around the world, including the United States, North America in general, also in the Far East, and certainly in Europe. And we took patients who had a version of MDS called lower risk MDS, just as we've described, and we randomized them to receive either imetelstat or placebo. Of course, they could continue to receive transfusions if needed. And so, for example, the majority of placebo patients continue to receive transfusions. And then percentage of patients that no longer needed transfusions really was the main outcome of that study, outcome measure of that study. And in our case, 40% of the patients had at least an 8-week transfusion-free interval in the imetelstat-treated or our drugs-treated arm, as opposed to the placebo-treated arm. What's really impressive, though, is that those patients actually went on to have, on average, about a year of not requiring transfusions. And that's really substantially better than you could do with any other drugs that have been on the market prior to this.
So that's what leads you to successful phase three. That's great. Now, a lot of people think, well, that means just go out and start manufacturing and distributing it to medical centers everywhere and doctors. But the truth is there's a space between successful phase three and this PDUFA date. PDUFA are the letters P-D-U-F-A. They come from the U.S. Government Act, Prescription Drug User Fee Act. And it has to do with that's the date that the FDA will have absolutely done a whole lot of stuff in reviewing exactly what went on. So tell us, as a company, you get these great results and you get from here to the PDUFA date. What do you do then?
Well, the first thing you do is you make an application to the government through the FDA to be allowed to market the product. And we call that a new drug application or NDA. And that generally is filed about a year before you would expect to be approved. And in that application, which covers literally all aspects of your drug, all aspects of the disease, you make all the arguments why the data strongly support the idea that the efficacy of the drug is more than adequate, and actually that the benefit risk of the drug is strongly in favor of treatment with the drug. And that's the fundamental lens through which the FDA looks. But of course, there are many, many different angles that are looked at in both the efficacy and the safety side of the product. Once you're through that review, if you will, then there's other things that you do with the FDA, which include agreeing on the professional instructions for use of the drug, which we call variously the package insert, which people would be very familiar with. You get a package insert. Most of the time you get a prescription drug. It's usually a very large piece of paper that's folded up very tiny and stuck on the drug's container. There's almost every aspect of the sale of a product in the United States via the approval of an NDA is covered in the whole review and approval process, down to what the advertising can say and how you can say it.
Now, I forgot to ask you, how many people were in that last phase three?
All right. There were 180 people in that last phase three. And as I said, they were in a large number of centers around the world.
A lot of people for a lot of months, Well, it's like, guess what? Your PDUFA date is coming right up, June 16th, 2024. You've turned in, I guess, just about everything to the FDA so far, and now you're waiting?
Yeah, there's some back and forth still, but what I would say is that right now the company is really focused on being ready to start to sell the product if approved. That would most likely come around the time of the PDUFA date, as you've said. And there's a huge amount of activity that's focused on supplying the commercial needs of the market once you do have approval. And you have to kind of anticipate that, right? Because you don't want to get an approval and then not be able to go out and provide the drug to the market in an appropriate way for months. And so we've hired sales reps. We've got a whole commercial team working on the correct messaging and the access to the healthcare system, which in this country is very complex and requires a lot of people to sort of navigate all the different ways that we end up getting drug to patients and we end up getting information to their healthcare providers and hematologists in this case, so that they know how best to use the drug and so forth.
Well, it's kind of amazing in one sense. It's like, well, we just talked about this for a few minutes. The PDUFA date's coming up in 4 weeks at the time of this interview. And this has been a 30-year journey. You just didn't get here now. I mean, tell us just sort of quickly, you know, what are the bones, the bare bones of that 30-year journey? And what does it feel like now?
So I will get to what it feels like now, which I can summarize very simply as saying it feels great. But the 30-year journey is what you often see behind the scenes in highly innovative products, because you really start out with a hypothesis that a certain mechanism, a certain enzyme to be targeted, whatever, is important and can be targeted, but you don't even have a drug to target it. And so the first thing you really work on usually is getting a drug. And that can take quite a number of years as you go through the process, you know, the chemistry and the biology of manufacturing and making a drug that is appropriate to interact with the target, in this case, the telomerase target. And then once you've done that, you have to do a lot of preclinical studies to establish appropriate doses and safety and efficacy. And then you go into the clinic. And as you know, Moira, there's usually phase one, which is first time in man. That's often looking for evidence of activity in different areas that you think might be valuable. Then once you've settled on that, then you have phase two, which explores dose and the way in which you give the product to patients and establishes the background for proving that your ideas about how to use the drug can be proved in what we call usually a double-blind and randomized controlled study, which is what is the long name for a phase three study, which establishes the strength of the data that regulators can look at and that they can hopefully believe in that allows you then to be approved.
30 years to be an overnight success. I think that
that's a good way to put it.
Kind of frames it.
Dr. John Scarlett is the president and CEO of Geron Corporation. More information is available at geron.com. That's G-E-R-O-N, geron.com. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.